Gladder Appellate Council.
Good morning, and may it please...
Before we have this argument, the last argument on the docket today, I want to point out that we're joined by Elizabeth Lacy here today, and this will be the last time that she sits on a session case. She may sit on a RIT panel here before too long, but she has decided that she's not going to serve as a senior justice in the future. And I think it's important to note that this justice was an enormously important trailblazer. She was the first woman to ever been appointed to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and she's been on this court for 30 years. She was appointed by, sadly, by Justice Belisle, who has passed away this week. It was a wonderful event, a sad coincidence that this will be the last day that Justice Lacy sits as a member of a full panel of the court. She has been a real champion for the cause of women in public life and a great colleague, and we're going to miss you.
Thank you.
All right, counsel, you may proceed now.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Nelson. I represent Futuri Real Estate in this matter. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
How many? Two?
Two.
Two, all right.
This case involves whether a party is bound to the language that it actually records in the land records, or whether a court will add to that recorded language so as to save that party from what it did record, particularly where, as here, they're dealing with a third-party purchaser for value. The salient minimum facts in this matter, there were three mortgages. SunTrust, though it closed the mortgage first, did not record first. They recorded second. Wells Fargo, through their predecessor in interest, Wachovia Bank, had recorded first. And then about a year later, Wells Fargo has the third mortgage, the third deed of trust, which they then recorded along with a subordination agreement, making the first deed of trust subordinate and junior to the third. And the operative language in that is, the lender hereby agrees that the lien of the original security instrument is subordinate and junior to the lien of the subsequent security instrument, and that the lien of the subsequent security instrument shall have a prior and superior right over the lien of the original security instrument. There's no mention of the intervening lien, and as far as I can tell, this is perhaps the only case that has involved a lender dealing with itself in a subordination agreement. Our position is that the complete subordination agreement, system that has been adopted by the minority of states but by some of Virginia's sister states should be the default in Virginia, and failing that it should still apply in this case where there is not an arm's-length transaction that the subordination agreement involves. This is a case where we're dealing with land records.
Can you follow up on the second point? Why would partial subordination be a bad choice for the court simply because Wells Fargo is dealing with Wells Fargo? What is it about that strikes you as not a good thing?
There's a point that's brought out in this court's decision in Tuscarora against BVA Credit, the 1978 case that gets closest to the circumstances in this case. in which they acknowledge that where there's a failure to have an arm's-length transaction in a subordination agreement, there is significant room for collusion between the parties to harm another lien holder. And in this case, that is, in fact, what happened and what Judge Bernhardt in the Fairfax Circuit Court recognized, that what Wells Fargo was trying to do was move both of their liens so that they had significant collateralization ahead of the SunTrust lien, so that in any subsequent action, both of those have to be taken into account before you get to the SunTrust lien. Even though the amount may be limited to the amount of the first lien, you still, over time, are continuing the security interest that Wells Fargo has at the expense of SunTrust, where normally you would expect those to pay down together. And so,
and if you're dealing with a non-arm's length transaction, is that risk? Is there any evidence in this case that the non-arm's length transaction produced a Machiavellian plan to accomplish the very result you were fearing?
This was decided on a motion to dismiss. There certainly was the inklings that that was either outside the scope of what the of what Wells Fargo even understood they were doing with this, or that. But to get directly to your point, yes, it does create problems when Wells Fargo forecloses on their own mortgage, which they have had the sale on that. Then there's the issue of what exactly they're foreclosing on. There's the issue then with how that payout is handled, and to the extent that there's everything that should have been extinguished by the SunTrust foreclosure retained, then that does harm SunTrust's original position and the holdings of Futuri Real Estate in this case. In Virginia...
Counsel, yes. When you're talking about holding harming SunTrust's position, your client is Futuri, who purchased the property. Why would SunTrust's position be, certainly in this situation, how could it have been affected by it?
Because, first, the order of priority still carries through to what it is that Futuri actually purchased.
But I'm asking you what SunTrust, you're talking about SunTrust's effect, the effect on this on SunTrust. How did that have any effect on SunTrust in this case?
That is primarily a policy matter. If there had been, if this had gone differently, if Wells Fargo had tried to foreclose
but
first.
But SunTrust is the one that foreclosed in this case, and
yes,
it was
it
completely satisfied.
Yes, it was.
I don't think you've answered that question yet. The question was, how were they hurt?
There is significant potential for their harm that, in this case, was passed on to Futuri rather than having been realized in this case. Yes, SunTrust was fully paid with the result of the foreclosure. The question that is primarily before this court is, what does Futuri actually own?
In this case, you're challenging the application of a partial subrogation agreement versus a complete subrogation agreement. You haven't challenged the actual amount that the trial court came up with. You're not arguing with the way it was applied, just that partial subrogation was applied versus complete. So aren't we really talking about the philosophical or the policy issue, as you're talking about, as to whether or not the court properly determined this was partial subrogation, it was allowable in Virginia, and the court came up with an amount in its opinion letter, but you didn't challenge its calculations of that amount.
Right, regardless of... Wells Fargo had enough that was junior to the SunTrust lien that regardless of how the interpleaded funds were distributed, Wells Fargo was going to end up with the end. Whether SunTrust's lien was in fact the first lien because of the subordination clause, or because they were partially subordinated, they still had that third position that would have taken any of the remaining funds.
Am I correct in saying you're not challenging the way the trial court applied the subrogation agreement, but that it applied the subrogation agreement rather than as a complete?
I don't see it
in your assignment of error that you're challenging the mathematical approach that the trial court applied, simply that it did not apply complete subrogation.
Correct. If partial subordination had been correct, then you do have to go through the labyrinthine calculations that the trial court did. If the complete subordination is applied, then that circuity of liens is avoided entirely, and it becomes the straightforward look at who is first, and then the junior liens are extinguished by the foreclosure action.
Can I take you back to Justice Lacey's first question, which is, if the theory is that when you do a partial subordination, you can't do it with someone that you're making a back deal with, including yourself, a non-conflict transaction, because there's all sorts of nefarious things that can come out of that. SunTrust was the only person that could get hosed in that sort of conspiracy, and they didn't. They maintained their position. They got their money back. So I'm obviously missing your point. What am I missing?
The point is that after that foreclosure sale, Mr. Futuri needs to be able to look at the land records, say, here is the order of liens, here is which of those liens I am is up for foreclosure. Mm-hmm. And at that point, in fact, he is in the worst situation out of anyone who's involved, because where the documents in the case appear to make SunTrust the first lien, yes, SunTrust is satisfied, yes, Wells Fargo gets the remaining money from the prior foreclosure, but now he is left with...
The documents in the case appear to make SunTrust the first lien. I thought the 2005 Wells Fargo lien was the first lien before the subordination agreement.
It was, and that is what comes up with the complete subordination question. In other words, this court has said in Tuscarora that it will not save a party from an inadvisable deal that it voluntarily enters into the land records. Mm-hmm. So when Futuri sees the advertisement of the foreclosure sale, goes to the land records, looks at what's there, the documents that are in the land records say it used to be Wells Fargo 1, SunTrust, Wells Fargo 2. Wells Fargo 1 has now become Junior 2, its own subsequent lien, which moves everyone up the ladder. That's what's written in the land records. And what Wells Fargo is asking this court to do is to apply a judicial solution to say, even though that's what was recorded, that's not what should happen. And that's where Mr. Futuri is harmed.
Okay. Counsel, I want to go back to Justice Lacey's question as well. If this court agrees with you that complete subordination ought to apply, obviously we're going to send it back to the trial court to do whatever calculation is necessary. But if we agree with the appellee that partial subordination applied, where in your assignments of error do you indicate that we ought to look over the math that the trial court did, and where do you put your opponent on notice that we ought to be looking at the calculations that the trial court made, if in fact we affirm on the question of partial subordination?
I don't think this court would have to review the math at that point.
So if we find partial subordination, then the case comes to an end. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And Judge Bernhardt, his opinion was more than 20 pages long and went into the detailed calculation. But that calculation shouldn't be necessary.
Counsel, could you find any case that was similar to this case in that the intermediate lien holder foreclosed, where the senior and the junior lien holders had entered into a partial subrogation subordination agreement that discussed how to apply that agreement?
My recollection of the other states' cases is that they primarily were dealing with how to actually pay out the money rather than which liens survived a foreclosure action.
But my question is, do you have any where a junior lienor is the one who brought the foreclosure action?
In this case, if complete subordination applies, it wouldn't actually be the junior lienor, and no, I don't.
So your answer is no.
Correct. Okay.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
I would, thank you.
May it please the court, Miriam Tadros here on behalf of the appellee, Wells Fargo Bank. Seated at council table is Michael Glasser and Shawnice Wilkerson. And this comes before the court today on an issue of first impression in the Commonwealth. And that issue is whether the court should adopt the partial subordination approach, which has been adopted by the majority of the courts, or whether this court should adopt the complete subordination approach. Our view, and the view of most states, is that the court should adopt the partial subordination approach.
Should we adopt partial subordination with a caveat to take into account the possibility, or at least the hypothetical, of some sort of self-dealing between the subordinated and the subordinator entities being exactly the same entity?
No, Justice. The reason for that is, if we look at what the partial subordination approach is, it's not trying to undo the liens. It's not trying to rewrite the land records. What it is saying is that if there are proceeds, we just distribute them differently. So if we have the first lien holder with $300,000, the second one with $200,000, and the third one with $100,000, when there are proceeds, you take out that $300,000, which was always going to be ahead of the second lien holder, and you distribute it. And then after you take out that $300,000, the second lien holder then gets their $200,000. And the reason that the courts have adopted that approach is that second lien holder is no better off using that approach, and they're no worse off using that approach. So the focus here would be, what is the most equitable thing? It would not be that this intervening lien holder, who was not a party to a subordination agreement and is not a third-party beneficiary to a subordination agreement because there's no clear intent to benefit that third party, they should not get the benefit of the subordination agreement.
From your perspective, it'd be a windfall.
Exactly, and that's what the courts have said, that the courts that have adopted the partial subordination approach said this would avoid a windfall. It is the fair result, it is the equitable result, and most importantly, it's in keeping with Virginia law, which states that we have to look at the intent of the parties when we're trying to understand the agreement.
Does it only apply to payout, or does it affect which liens survive a foreclosure?
It would not affect which liens survive.
So it doesn't then result in Wells Fargo 1 and Wells Fargo 2 both now having a lien in some amount against Futura's property?
Respectfully, yes. I would assert that what we had argued in the motion to dismiss before Judge Bernhard was this does not change the land records. It cannot change the land records because we have the 55-59.3, I believe, that says this is how you pay it out, and we have to look at recordation. It does not change recordation. All it says is that when there's this pot of money, there is just a different way that that pot of money is distributed.
Okay, then I misunderstood your answer to my question. It does not then result, once SunTrust forecloses, with Wells Fargo 2 being in first priority position, it does not result in their lien now being a lien on the property?
The $415,000 first Wells Fargo lien survives the foreclosure sale. That's because that once SunTrust forecloses, it can only foreclose down. It will wipe out the second Wells Fargo lien, which is the third lien on the property. So SunTrust forecloses, second Wells Fargo lien is gone. The first Wells Fargo lien remains on the property. That's in keeping with Virginia law. How those funds, how the proceeds are allocated is an issue of contract between the first lien and the third lien. It has no impact on SunTrust, and it has no impact on anybody else because it's a subordination agreement.
So the first Wells Fargo lien remains a lien on the property in what amount?
$415,000. It's whatever the lien amount is. So Mr. Futuri, when he purchases it at a foreclosure sale, he knows exactly what he is getting. If there was a lien on the property and that was a first lien and there was a foreclosure of the second lien is gone. The third lien is gone. The first lien remains on the property. So
but
that
it is not increased. Are you saying that it would not be increased by the amount of the subrogated amount?
The lien amount of the second
Wells Fargo?
It's not increased. Whatever the priority is the priority. Except now, for instance, in this case, we had $201,000 that were the surplus funds. How those surplus funds are applied is going to be different because of the subordination agreement. That is the change. It does not affect which liens survive foreclosure and which liens don't, because that's already governed by the Virginia Code.
So you're saying that Wells Fargo 2 gets satisfied and Wells Fargo 1 retains a $415,000 lien on this property?
Yes, except now when we have the $200,000, because Wells Fargo 3 or Wells Fargo 2 was in third position and their priority jumped up to first position, what happens is that $201,000 goes to satisfy the first Wells Fargo lien. Part of it remains unsatisfied, and all of Wells Fargo 3 remains unsatisfied. So if there are proceeds that come out, I'll stop there. But that's an issue between Wells Fargo and Wells Fargo, the people that entered into the subordination agreement, and how they apply the funds. It doesn't affect which liens get wiped out and which liens stay on the property.
Can I ask you this?
I'm a little bit confused by this colloquy, so let me actually approach it with a little bit more simplicity. At this moment, does Wells Fargo have exactly $415,000 that is secured by the property, or does Wells Fargo have more than $415,000 of principal that is secured by the property?
It has $415,000 of principal secured by the property.
Okay.
Because that would be in keeping with Virginia law and when Mr. Futuri took that property. And what our position was in our motion to dismiss is that the subordination agreement only had the effect of changing how distributions were allocated. It could never serve to oversecure the property, which goes to the issue of what if there's collusion. You can't use a subordination agreement to somehow make two Wells Fargo liens ahead of a SunTrust lien.
So what you're trying to say is the liens aren't affected technically at all, ever, because they're governed by the record statutes. But how you move the money around among the creditors, they can do whatever they want to do.
Exactly. And that is the freedom of contract. And so we had cited the Co-Alliance case.
Excuse me, counsel, before you go on, I don't want your time to run out, because really one of the questions here is the intent of the Wells Fargo 1 and 2 when they entered into the subordination agreement. By adopting the partial subordination approach, are you saying that under no circumstances would it ever be could such an agreement be a complete subordination approach?
We'd have to look at the subordination agreement itself to ascertain the intent of the parties. And there could be situations where there would be a complete subordination if that were the intent of the parties.
Well, but couldn't a partial subordination say this does not affect our priorities within the agreement?
It could. And there are going to be issues that trial courts are going to have to resolve across the state in attempting to figure this out. But if they do, that would give the intent of the parties meaning. because you could have cases where they want a partial subordination. So the co-alliance case where someone was going to fund crops for a certain year, and that entity says, yes, but we need to have a first lien position. We're helping out a struggling property. And traditional banks may not want to do that, but you could get somebody else. And that would be good for the traditional banks, but the person who's going to give you priority doesn't want to be kicked to the back of the line if there are four liens. So this would allow these types of situations to happen. It would allow commercial transactions to function, you know, the way that they are intended to function. Because if someone says, yes, I can help you out with the crops, but the first person in line says, well, I don't want to go to the back of the line, then they may never get that funding. They don't enter into a subordination agreement, and the property continues to struggle. So parties should be able to freely contract to give up certain lien priorities, but to a certain extent.
Well, are you saying then that in a situation that doesn't say this is a partial subordination or this is a complete subordination, that if it's silent on that, that our default position will be always a subordination agreement?
Well, if there's a
subordination.
If there is a subordination agreement, the default position would be it's a partial subordination, that the court adopts the partial subordination approach, and the court examines the four corners of the documents to determine the intent of the parties. But if we go to a partial subordination approach, that is the more equitable approach, and it would aid commercial transactions. It would avoid a windfall. And the main case that goes for the complete subordination approach, even acknowledged the AmSouth case that relied on ITT Diversified, which got overturned by the Texas Supreme Court, it states that the first lien holder could always assign their interest to a junior lien holder. Well, if they could do that and they can change how proceeds are distributed, why can't they enter into a subordination agreement that accomplishes the same thing and preserves the rights of the intervening lien holder?
Isn't the bottom line that the subordination agreements, when they're characterized as partial, really don't affect the landowner at all?
The landowner? No, they don't. They do not.
So, I mean, the liens are what they are. They're in the recorded sequence that they're supposed to be, and no one can monkey around with that unless they want to change the land records. But the money at the payoff stage of a foreclosure can go to whoever the parties want to send it to.
Yes. And if the lien holders decide that they want to reach an agreement that doesn't interfere with the rights of an intervening lien holder and it doesn't interfere with the rights of a landowner, like a subordination agreement, they should be free to do so. And the cases saying that they're not free to do so are not compelling cases. So AmSouth and I think Old Stone from Georgia say, well, let's look at the definition of subordination agreement. It means a lowering of priority. And they rely on that definition and disregard the actual content of the parties, of the subordination agreement and the intent of the parties. There's no reasonable justification to use the complete subordination approach. And I would submit that the partial subordination approach would be in line with Virginia law regarding the freedom to contract. With respect to the particular subordination agreement at issue, the trial court correctly found that it was unambiguous. It's not required to recite all of the intervening lien holders. In fact, all of the cases that we had cited from ITT to Wells Fargo versus Nielsen, all of them that adopted the partial subordination approach, most of those cases, there was no mention of the intervening lien holder, and the court said there's an agreement between party one, there's an agreement between party and party two, where they have this exchange. We don't find an ambiguity, and we understand the intent of the parties. There's nothing ambiguous in the subordination agreement itself. It identifies the first lien, it identifies the second lien, it identifies the transaction, and it states that the priority of the second Wells Fargo lien is going to be ahead of the first Wells Fargo lien. So the document itself, there are no issues with its interpretation. So given that the majority of courts have adopted the partial subordination approach, and given that the subordination agreement itself is unambiguous, Wells Fargo would ask that this court affirm the trial court's ruling, adopt the partial subordination approach and find that the $415,000 first lien was not extinguished by the foreclosure, and that the parties are free to allocate the proceeds from a foreclosure sale or a bankruptcy or whatever it is that they may be in what way they see fit, because it does not harm an intervening lien holder and it does not harm the owner. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you. And respectfully, subordination has to affect the order of priority because in the foreclosure statute it states that the foreclosure extinguishes the junior liens but not the uphill ones. And with respect to the question about it affecting the landowner, if the landowner is falling behind on payments, it is absolutely going to affect his decision making, because the probability that an under-collateralized piece of property is going to have the third mortgage foreclosed on is significantly lower than that of the first.
But why does he care? He can't pay the first.
Well, if he has to choose between the two, he will pay the first and not the third. With respect to the freedom of the parties, they can absolutely enter into an agreement, but the burden should be on the party who's actually recording the document in the land records to make it clear by what they record, as opposed to pushing that burden off onto some other party who is merely looking at that document and has no indication from it of the hornet's nest he's stepping into. Thank you.
This session of the Supreme Court is adjourned.
All rise.